I'm really pleased to be here, not only because I finally have a good tool for crowd control in my hands, and because this, like the country I'm from, is sort of pocket crazy, but also because this is the first time in my life I'm here at the Fridner Institute, and for me, I've been looking forward to this trip for a long time, calling it my Hajj, you know, my pilgrimage to Mecca, because this is the first time in my life I'm actually in a place where I can talk, where I get the feeling that it's actually okay to be interested in foundational questions. So this is my coming out of the closet day, okay? Just to give you a little bit of a background to understand where I'm coming from. The weird part of this talk, of this stuff, goes back to a paper I wrote in 1996. And when I first showed that to my boss at the time, John McCall, I didn't actually show it at all. I was outed by a friend. And he said, let me see this, and went off with it. And then later on, I was sitting in my office doing something else, and he comes in, opens the door, like, thank you, slaps it down on my desk, and leaves, and slams the door shut. That's how encouraged I used to have been feeling and felt, you know, thinking about foundational questions. And this is my coming out of the closet moment, and you're the victims. So what are we going to talk about today? Well, I'm going to start by talking, giving you a brief update of the more stuff which used to be considered flaky and not respectable in the 60s and 70s, cosmology, give you an update on a lot of exciting things that have happened there, and then talk more about this even more speculative stuff towards the second half of the talk, some more philosophical reflections about what it might tell us about foundations, both some building on those older ideas and also about a new paper, which I thought I was going to finish yesterday, but I didn't quite make it, so it should hopefully be out like in a week or so, which fleshes out and extends some of those ideas some more. So without further ado, let's delve into the universe by reminding ourselves about what we humans have learned so far during the first 100,000 years on this planet about our place in space. Now, I'm a theorist, so I have no idea which button to press to turn the lights on or off. Is this it? Is this as dark as it gets?
Yeah, you can
dark. Yeah, I do. So just to make sure we're all on the same page, let's just remind ourselves we live in this pizza-shaped galaxy, the Milky Way, about 100,000 light years from side to side. And if we zoom in really close to home, this is not a computer simulation. This is a real three-dimensional map, okay, painstakingly built up by astronomers around the world of what the star distribution looks like nearby. And when we come really close to home, you don't want to go too close to the sun. It hurts. But just to set scales here and remind you of the perspective, as you all know, it takes about 8 minutes for light to get from the sun out to the radius of the Earth. The ancient Greeks only knew about the planets out to Saturn, because that's all you can see with the naked eye. And it takes a few hours for light to get to the outer edges of the solar system. Yet it's vastly farther away, of course, than the nearest stars. Sure, right, the closest one is about 3 light years away. And the typical star, so you might see at night, if you go out for a walk, light has taken hundreds of years to get here. So someone out there looking back here wouldn't see us. They would see the British and the French fighting a war in Canada or something like that. And as we zoom out more, we get reminded that, of course, all these stars are just a small fraction of the 10 to the 11 of the hundreds of billions of stars that make up the Milky Way galaxy. And if we zoom out more, we get into my day job, you know, cosmology. If we zoom out enough that the Milky Way shrinks down to just a little speck, all these other dots now are not stars, they're galaxies, hundreds of billions of stars on their own. And it's just remarkable how fast the field has advanced, because when my grandma passed away recently at age 102, I was reflecting a bit on her life, and I realized that, you know, when she was going on her first date, people didn't even know if there were other galaxies or not. That was only settled in 1925 by Edwin Hubble, who showed that Andromeda wasn't the wispy little gas cloud in the neighborhood between the stars, but actually millions of light years away. And let's just for fun now pretend that the speed of light is infinite, so we can drive around the neighborhood. and see what cosmologists across the world have mapped out so far. So this is the neighborhood, okay? We are now hundreds of millions of light years away from home, and I want you to notice two important things. The first is that galaxies are social animals that like to hang out near other galaxies in groups, clusters, superclusters, and gigantic filaments. That's, of course, because gravity is an attractive force and likes to clump things together. And since most of the matter is dark matter, what you're seeing here is a reasonably good proxy for a map of the dark matter distribution, if there is such a thing as dark matter, which we will return. Now, the second thing I want you to notice, besides clumpiness, is that by now, it's beginning to get a little bit repetitive. Been there, done that, you know. And I bet if I sometimes have these nightmares when I play with this, that this is for real. In which case, I would, there's no way I'd be able to find my way home. Because it starts to look kind of the same everywhere. Like, I'm lost. And this becomes even more clear if we zoom out still more and notice that the density of galaxies is roughly the same everywhere. Statistically, things look sort of the same all over the place, which is what we cosmologists mean when we in tech jargon say that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic on large scales. It's not until you zoom out still more that you see that the universe is actually cubed. Having lived in the US, this is, of course, just a lame pitch for more science fun. So it's quite remarkable how fast our understanding of our place in space has improved. Yet, we've also dramatically improved our understanding of our place in time. We're very lucky in astronomy in that it's much easier for us to find out what happened in the past than it is for some historian who wonders about ancient Rome, because we can see it. The sky is a time machine, and as you all know, we can see things from which it's taken light many, many billions of years to travel here. So because of this homogeneity and isotropy of the universe being statistically sort of the same everywhere, by looking at how it was over there in the distant past, we can get a good idea of what it was probably like over here in the distant past. And as you know, this is the basic picture which has emerged so far. We know that about 14 billion years ago, something really weird happened. We don't know exactly what. We have a fancy name for it, the Big Bang. And since then, there are two basic physical processes which have taken place. The first is expansion. So that, of course, implies that the stuff in the universe has then gotten diluted from being denser to more rarefied, from being hotter to being cooler. But there's also a second process, which is equally important, which is an increase in clumpiness. The universe went from being very uniform, with fluctuation levels in the density at the around 10 to minus 5, which coincidentally is about the same as the fluctuation in the density when I speak this loudly in the air in this room. I don't know if you, Lee, have an anthropic explanation for that, but I haven't found one. And, but it was very boring early on. Uniform hydrogen gas, and gradually, this clunkiness was amplified by gravity into the galaxies and the large-scale structure that we see around us in the universe today. And of course, we want to measure both the expansion history and the clumping history. I'm going to speak much more in detail about this tomorrow in a technical seminar. So if there's someone who's still awake at the end of this and wants to suffer more, you're welcome to that. And why do we know all this? Well, basically because of data. We've enjoyed an avalanche of high-precision data in a whole host of different fields. And I want to emphasize that even though you may have heard a lot about some fields, like microbefront, there's a large number of different areas where the progress has been really astonishing. What is this microwave background? Let me just remind you that when I look really, really far away in that direction, since I'm looking backward in time, if I look far enough in that direction, I'm eventually going to look back at an epoch when it was so hot that the hydrogen that filled space was ionized. It was an opaque hydrogen plasma, many thousands of Kelvin. Okay, so it's going to look like I'm staring into this wall. But of course, it's going to look exactly the same if I look in that direction, or in that direction, or in any other direction. And giving this impression that I'm actually looking at the inside of an opaque sphere, which we often like to plot sort of like this. When we plot these things, we often plot them so it looks like you're looking at the universe from outside. And of course, that's just because we have a problem with graphics. these are the beautiful images from the Wilkinson microwave anisotropy probe, where we've cleaned that worked hard to clean out the radio noise from stuff in the foreground. So, I've mentioned all this beautiful data. What has it taught us so far about our place in time? Let me just summarize very, very briefly the broad brush picture which has emerged from this so far, how we all got here. First of all, let's take a look at this simulation by Ben Moore and his group, where we see both the process of expansion and the process of clumping taking place simultaneously. This is simply a gravity simulation, but with a order billion particles in a supercomputer, eventually forming a very, very complicated mess of stuff, which may correspond ultimately to a large cluster of galaxies at the present time. So physics you put in is simple, just all very boring initial conditions with small fluctuations in the density, and then in the end you get something very complicated from the great destabilizer, gravity. To make it a little more clear that there were these two different things involved, I'm now going to show you a very similar movie, but in coordinates where I've removed the expansion, plotting the so-called co-moving coordinates that's happening instead. Now you can see more directly the increased clumping that's taking place, how a very boring and almost uniform initial state gradually transitions into something like what we flew around in this flight simulator for hundreds of millions of light years from side to side, and every overdense clump here might correspond to a site where a galaxy forms. So let's keep zooming in. Let's zoom in now and look at what's emerged from studies of formation of an individual galaxy. This is from Matthias Steinmetz and his group in Potsdam. And what we're looking at here on the left side of the screen is the same thing from the top as we're seeing in a side view on the right side of the screen here. And what we're seeing here are stars that are beginning to switch on, form, gradually more and more of them, and in turn get pulled together into a proto-galaxy here by gravitational forces. And the basic lesson that's been learned from these simulations of galaxy formation is that the old picture people had was largely wrong. It was the idea that our galaxy formed at some particular instant, and then it was there, is really quite misleading. It was much more of a gradual and messy buildup, where you had a lot of little things which were galaxies in their own right, but they constantly merged and smashed together in large traffic accidents and hostile corporate takeovers, growing into larger and larger things. So, in fact, even if you look around us right now in the Milky Way, there's very clear evidence, much of it rather recent, that the Milky Way has cannibalized a lot of other little innocent nearby galaxies in the recent past. And even as we speak, a little innocent, well, I don't know how innocent it was, but a neighboring galaxy, Sagittarius, is being eaten up by the Milky Way. And even now, so now gradually we see that we're settling into something which looks in the top view much like the pizza of a real galaxy. And from the side, you see the newer stars are nicely settled into a flat disk, but the much, much older stars are spread out in a rather spherical way. And this is also where most of the mass, the way most of the mass is spread out, at least in standard general relativity, where the attributes most of this mass to being some rather spherical dark matter halo. So, and all of these areas, of course, they're very active, everything's provisional, there are many outstanding puzzles, but I think it's nonetheless quite remarkable how a broad brush picture has started to emerge, which actually makes quite a lot of sense. Thanks to this combination of both data, a lot of clever theory, and the awesome power of recent computer and algorithms that have come online. Here's another example of that. Tom Abel and his collaborators from Penn State and Stanford have perfected this fantastic adaptive mesh refinement technique, where you keep zooming in on the part of your simulation where the time scale is the shortest, and they can zoom in by 12 orders of magnitude, starting with something the size of a whole galaxy, ending up with something the size of a star, thereby getting absolutely stupendous dynamic. And if we continue this farther and look into what happens on the scale of an individual star, we can end up with solar system simulations like this one, where you have a gas cloud which is slowly rotating and contracting under its own gravity while it's giving off its energy, its radiation, and settling into a disk. And in the core of the disk, you get a very, very dense clump, which eventually gets hot enough it ignites thermonuclear fusion, becomes a star. And all the while, stuff is also clumping here inside the gas disk into a number of clumps that are orbiting here. And when this protostar eventually succeeds in blowing off with the radiation pressure and other mechanisms, the residual gas, you see these planets which had formed surrounding it. And since all the angular momentum came from this initial cloud, it's no surprise that all the planets in our solar system are spinning in the same way, orbiting around the sun in the same direction, which is also the same direction as the sun itself is rotating, except for one or two notable exceptions, as people put down to catastrophic collisions. And finally, continuing your journey to get still closer to home, I find it quite striking how even our planet keeps changing. And when I first heard of plate tectonics, I used to think that 200 million years sounded like such a long time. But in this context of this lecture, 200 million years is nothing. It's less than 3% of the age of the universe. Right? And we've now gone from very early moments up to present, so let's continue a little bit into the future for kicks. This is another simulation from Matthias Steinmetz and his group in Potsdam. Here's the Milky Way. Our solar system here in red is seen orbiting the galactic center. And here is Andromeda, our nearest big neighbor. And it's 2 billion years from now, a scary-looking approach. They don't come head-on because of their initial velocities and pulls from other objects in the surroundings. But eventually, there's going to be a big traffic accident here. As you see, about 4 billion years into the future, boom. And look at this, our solar system now in a very scary orbit, getting rather near the supermassive black hole here. And here comes the big whammy. Boom, about 5 billion years into the future. And then eventually, these two supermassive black holes are believed to merge, they will merge. And you'll have one super galaxy, because the stars don't actually hit each other head. This is also roughly the time scale on which our sun will have died. So we have a few things to worry about on that time scale, although I think my personal worries are much shorter time scales, mainly dominated by things, bad things that we humans like to do ourselves.
Sorry if I interrupt, but is that a firm prediction? Is that based on sketchy knowledge about initial conditions and dynamical ingredients and so on?
I would say it's fairly sketchy. We know these velocities relatively well, but there's clearly a lot of uncertainties and these are chaotic. Some aspects of these problems manage to show instabilities also. So I think it's fairly clear that Andromeda and Milky Way are going to merge on that time scale, but the exact details of what's going to happen to our solar system and so on, I think we're going to understand much better in 5 or 10 years when we have better measurements of those velocities. So that's just a very, very brief summary of what we've learned so far about our place in space and our place in time. Tomorrow I'm going to spend the whole seminar talking in great detail about the evidence for all of this and why you should believe any of it. And also highlighting more the open questions, whether there is dark matter, dark energy, things like that. Let me just today give you a little bit of a flavor of one piece of research I've been working very hard on for the last 2 years. Together with a very long list of collaborators from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey collaboration. This is a project we just finished. It just got published. And so this is our observable universe. Again, the sphere from which light has time to reach us so far. And of course, the ultimate goal of astrophysics is to map the entire interior of this. Right? So far, we have a good map just of the surface of it. And in terms of mapping inside, we haven't gotten very far at all. There's an exciting new technique we can talk about tomorrow, which might do a great job here. But for now, all the galaxy surveys from the 2-degree field team, from the FDSS team, up until before this year, was all just mapping out the little region shown in green in the middle, the tiny fraction of the volume. And now I'm going to tell you about the red stuff here. So we have quasars, luminous red galaxies, and ordinary galaxies. Quasars can see out to redshifts of 6 or so, but they're very sparsely spread out. And we have these luminous red galaxies, and then there are a lot of run-of-the-mill galaxies, which are most of the ones that we've been able to map so far. And these luminous red galaxies, I think of them as Goldilocks galaxies, because they're just right. They're the perfect galaxies for measuring the cosmic clustering, so-called power spectrum, which gives us much of the information we have now about cosmological parameters. And you can show that about 60,000 of those gives you as much information about what you care about as 2 million ordinary galaxies. And the reason is simply that we're trying to map out the density fluctuations. And the ordinary galaxies are just so densely packed in there that you're oversampling. You wouldn't learn much more if you had more of them. The quasars are too sparse, whereas these luminous red galaxies have just the optimal number density. So we've mapped these out in great detail. And what one does, in short, is compare the measured distribution of these galaxies in 3 dimensions, like what we flew through, with calculations from computer simulations and analytic techniques to see if one can get a match. And one can only get a match if one fits for some free parameters. There are important physics parameters, like how much dark matter there is, and other cosmological parameters. And just to give you a little bit of a flavor of what's been happening here recently, some parameters we like to measure is what the universe is made up of, the cosmic matter budget. You've seen numbers like these before. And it's easy to forget, though, how fast much of this has changed. So why am I so excited about this? Let's look, for example, at the density of dark matter plotted against the density of ordinary matter. Well, it's been known for a long time, from Big Bang nucleosynthesis, roughly how much ordinary matter you have to have. You have to be in that green band at 95% confidence. But only 7 years ago did the micro-wraparound measurements finally get good enough to take a big bite out of this plot and exclude all the red stuff here at 95% confidence. Only in 2003 did the Wilkinson satellite WMAP manage to finally encircle the enemy and say, it's in here somewhere, the truth. You must have dark matter in standard GR, because all of this stuff with no dark matter is firmly excluded. And the recent WMAP data that came out this in 2006 with polarization enormously tightened this still. When you throw in galaxy information, you can cut the error bars on the dark matter by another factor of 2. And of course, there's a whole host of other exciting numbers you can also measure. For instance, how flat is space? Is it curved on large scales or not? And it's well known in general relativity that if the parameter omega matter density, plus this dark energy parameter omega lambda add up to 1, space is going to be flat. Well, what does the data say? This is what WMAP told us in 2003. This is what we knew from the micro background in 2006. So the answer is, well, it's sort of flat, but you could still be out here. In fact, at a couple of sigma, you could have no dark energy at all and have a rather closed universe. But if you throw in the galaxies also, it's very complementary information. The only region that's allowed is right there. And you get this amazing measurement, the omega total, which inflation predicts should be 1 plus minus 10 to minus 5 or so. It's 1.003 plus minus 1%. It's really quite remarkable, in my opinion.
How far out are we, and what values of z correspond to the omega
n's? So this is just telling you how much, what fraction of, so the total density of matter, say, per photon, and per microwave photon, which is independent of redshift. So it's
how far out?
The measurements themselves are coming from about a redshift of 1,000 for the micro background, and a redshift of about 0.1, 0.2, 0.3 for these. So those are just a couple of examples. And there's, of course, enormous numbers of parameters here. They're too small for you to read. If anyone is interested in rattling parameters off to their friends, you can come up to me afterwards and get my one-page summary of everything you need, all the numbers of the universe here, with definitions of them. I mentioned already to you the cosmic matter budget. Then there is a bunch of numbers which tell us about these mysterious 10 to minus 5 fluctuations that were there early on and their nature. The history of the universe has become more quantitative. After arguing for decades about whether the universe was 10 or 20 billion years old, or 2 billion years old for that matter, we now know that the universe got dominated by matter at about 63,000 years. We combined at about 400,000 years, got reionized at about 400 million years, started accelerating after 7 billion years, and the Perimeter Institute was constructed after about 14 billion years. And the error bars are kind of approaching the percent level on some of these things. So in summary, I think it's interesting to reflect that when John McCall walked into my office and slammed the door shut on me, you know, back in those days, we were all talking about the future. We were going to get all this exciting data, and we were going to use it to measure these cosmological parameters, and that was going to be so cool. Well, here we are. The community has come together and actually measured these parameters quite well. So now what? Are we done? Should all cosmologists switch to something else? Well, here's what I think. I think we're not done at all. I think, in fact, the most fun part of cosmology lies ahead. Because behind each parameter lies a question. We've measured the density of dark matter. We have no clue what dark matter is, and it's not even clear that it exists. We have measured the density of dark energy. We have no clue what that is. We measured this fluctuation level of the 10 to minus 5 in the early universe, but we don't know what it was that produced of that. We don't know where these particular numbers actually come from. There's 32 free parameters in the standard model of particle physics that include these six for cosmology. We would like to compute some of them, at least, from something more fundamental. And we have an enormous avalanche of still better data ahead in cosmology, which is coming in on a very fast time scale. So a few years from now, we'll have data that blows away all of what we've seen today. So there's an enormous opportunity to use these better measurements to tackle these deeper physics questions, which I think is going to be really, really great fun. And I'll elaborate much more on tomorrow. To summarize the pseudo-respectable part of this talk, then, I think the universe right now is a very happy place for cosmologists. So this is where we now go off the deep end. So that's all fine, but this is the Perimeter Institute, right? We're trying to understand whether we can understand all of this in terms of some fundamental theory of everything. And a particular question that I'm very intrigued by is whether we can actually describe our external physical reality purely mathematically. That's this paper that John McCall got so upset about. And this is this this sequel. I can give you a copy of it. And I want to center my discussion around exploring a couple of hypotheses. Okay, the first one I'm calling the external reality hypothesis, namely the hypothesis that there exists an external physical reality which is completely independent of us humans. I'm also going to talk about the mathematical universe hypothesis, hence the title of this talk, that our external physical reality is a mathematical structure. So the external reality hypothesis sounds pretty innocuous. You know, sure, if you're a solipsist, you're not going to buy it. But surely everybody else is going to buy it. I don't think so, actually, if you think a little more about it. Because, for example, these two guys, who I respect immensely, Heisenberg and Bohr, I wouldn't be surprised if they would beg to disagree. They might say something like, well, you know, observation plays a really fundamental role in reality. And doesn't make sense to talk about this, these sort of things, without the observer and us. And here at the Perimeter Institute, you have this very noble experiment to see whether you can convert a massive influx of caffeine into a theory of everything, which is, by definition, a complete description of this external physical reality. Right? So if the external physical reality is completely independent of us humans, right, then it must be describable. This complete description here must be devoid of any human baggage. Let me explain what I mean by human baggage. We humans have our own human language, you know, English, French, Swedish, whatever, and we use a lot of words that we treat the interpretation that come with baggage. No, if I say object or particle, now you and everybody else I talk to, we have a common understanding of what we mean by this, because we have a common cultural heritage, right? I don't need to explain what I mean by an experiment. But if I have a theory of everything which involves human language like this, there's no way I can explain it to my super intelligent computer at home, or to some intelligent alien, say, right? That's not part of their common cultural heritage at all. So it's a real challenge to see if there can be such a thing as a complete description of reality which doesn't involve any of this human baggage. Now, many of you have worked hard on, for example, how you can extract classical mechanics from non-relativistic quantum theory, and you know that there's a lot more to it than taking h bar to zero. But you also know that this is just a small piece of a larger puzzle, whereby we can derive more applied theories from more fundamental ones and various limits. Okay? And I've sorted them in this little family tree of theories here from less to more baggage. So if you look at the ratio in these theories of words to equations, it approaches infinity when you go down here to very wide areas. And conversely, if there is a baggage-free description here, there should be a theory of everything then which is purely mathematical, with no human language in it at all. That ratio should go to zero. Now, what would that then mean in terms of requirement? Well, that must mean that the entities in this description of the external physical reality must be purely abstract entities, which have no implicit meanings at all. And rather, the only properties that these abstract entities can have are the ones which are given implicitly by their relations between the entities. Right. Now, a mathematical structure is precisely a bunch of abstract entities with relations between them. Right? You're a good friend with lots of mathematical structures in this family tree, and of course there are infinitely many mathematical structures. And it's important to remember that the way in which you get rid of baggage when you define a mathematical structure is by defining them as an equivalence class. There are many different ways in which you can define a given group. You can use symbols A, B, C, or G1, G2, G3 for the elements, or whatever. But then you say the two are equivalent if there's a mapping from one to the other that preserves all the structure. And then you say that the structure itself is just this one that you mod out this equivalence class of descriptions. Right? The thing which you're describing is the equivalence class itself. That's exactly the way, for instance, you would define a manifold, right? When you define a manifold, you have these charts, you have an atlas of all the charts, but there are many different atlases, and you don't want the manifold of the sphere to have anything to do with whether you took out the North Pole as special or whatever, so you say it's an equivalence class of all possible ones. Okay, it's a fairly familiar notion. Yet, this is a pretty subtle notion, too, which it's easy to miss. And one of the critiques that people have been sending me over the last decade about this whole idea is very linked to that. People will say things like, well, you know, saying that something is that the universe is a mathematical structure is meaningless because everything is a mathematical structure. Like, suppose I say God created heaven and earth. Then I could argue that, well, you know, there are three entities, you know, God, heaven, earth, and there is a relation called creation here. So, and God creates this, God creates that, so surely this is a mathematical structure. And I've even gotten emails saying things like, well, this must prove the existence of God, because then if all mathematical structures exist, which we'll get to later, then there must be one where God exists, and then God is, of course, omnipotent, so God can insert himself into all the other structures, and therefore there's a God in ours, yeah, et cetera, et cetera. And the key thing to remember is this business about getting rid of the baggage, right? Equivalence classes. So, since the entities are supposed to be purely abstract, you're not allowed to have a bunch of baggage and connotations. So instead of drawing heaven like this, it's better to draw heaven like this. Just three abstract elements, right? Likewise, the relations. And same thing, the labels for them this is equivalent to calling them God, heaven, and earth, to calling them, say, S1, S2, and S3. You can call them by any level label they want. It's the same structure. And likewise, I can call the relation R instead of created if I want. And at this point, it's clear, when I've distilled away all the baggage, that the mathematical structure I'm talking about here is just what mathematicians usually call an ordered graph, which is a particular which you can just specify by a little 3x3 matrix of zeros and ones, right, show which arrows are in this. That's just a very, very simple example. But all mathematical structures, be it the sphere or a 3 plus 1 dimensional pseudo-Riemannian manifold or some Hilbert space, have the same property, that the elements in there are just purely abstract and don't come with any baggage.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I don't think you have replaced human baggage with nothing. You replace human baggage with another human baggage, meaning mathematics. It also could be sort of a difference.
This is a great question, which if it's okay, I would love to come back to you afterwards, because we can discuss it at great length. And as you know, mathematicians themselves love to have spirited discussion and disagree also about amongst themselves about what mathematics really means with, between the different schools. So promise me you'll ask me this again afterwards, okay? Because I wanted to spend a little bit of time on, after having just thrown out this hypothesis, which you're welcome to buy or not buy, that there is this external reality independent of us humans. But just talk a little bit about what it might imply. Yeah.
So your diagram where you turned God and whatever it is, the earth and the heaven into an arrow is interesting, because basically another way I can see what you're saying is in the abstract that I have a mathematical structure, let's say, of category theory.
Yes.
But then I have to choose specific representations when I describe the physical world. So then I care about the details, whether this is heaven or a vector space or specific particular
right.
paths between things.
But what exactly?
And the mathematics becomes good to describe nature when I choose those representations.
But what I'm going to get to is this hypothesis that, it's, that the whole world is isomorphic to a mathematical structure means that this theory of everything has to be a purely mathematical prescription. So you can't also associate heaven with harp music unless somehow the whole definition of what a harp is, you know, is built into some other relations in the structure itself. You have to specify everything, really everything. There can't be sort of any implicit loose ends. Right. So that's a good point. So what I've argued here then is that this, if you take this external reality hypothesis really, really seriously and define a mathematical structure the way I did, then this of course just implies the mathematical universe hypothesis. So you're forced into this notion that we live in a mathematical structure. And again, you don't have to be forced into this. Niels Bohr wouldn't be forced into it because he would reject that already. And he was pretty good as a physicist anyway, even though we Swedes love to make fun of the Danes.
So just to clarify, if
yeah.
you rejected that, you would be saying that there isn't the it's the independence of humans that is under contest here.
Exactly. Right? That's really the crux of the matter. Precisely. And now, what are some implications of this? The first thing has to do with phenomenology. The whole, and there's a very subtle point here, I think, which is that there are two very different ways in which you can look at a mathematical structure. You can either look at it from what I'm going to call the bird's view, the way a mathematician would look down on a mathematical structure just from its abstract definition. Study it as a mathematician and see what properties does it have. And maybe if you're infinitely smart, you can then derive, oh, this mathematical structure contains within it self-aware substructures which are going to be observers and are going to perceive themselves as existing in a physically real perimeter institute, and so on. Clearly very hard, but you can imagine that. That's what I'm going to call the bird's view. Then, if there are indeed self-aware entities in there, like us, right, that's not at all how we perceive this mathematical structure. We say, hey, this chocolate tastes good, you know. And so this is what I'm calling the frog's view, the way, the in our face, the way we perceive reality. So the ultimate phenomenology challenge in this context is, if you're given a mathematical structure, the bird's view, how do you derive from that what the frog's view would be? How do you, given just a mathematical structure, analyze it mathematically to figure out what it's actually like living in this universe? And in my opinion, this is a very difficult question. If you go back and look at history, we see that early on, like in the days of Newton, the distinction wasn't so great. You could think of the outside view of Newtonian celestial mechanics as some curves in R4, which corresponded to the motion of planets, and then you could look out in the sky and you could see planets. But then, if you look at special relativity, say, this got much more subtle. There, we already had the right equations written down by people like Lorentz and Minkowski, but it took the genius of Einstein, in my opinion, to make this connection and say, well, if this is the math of special relativity in this case, then from the frog's perspective, it's going to seem like time slows down when you move fast. It's going to seem like hockey sticks get shorter when they move fast. Very, very subtle stuff. And in my opinion, the most crucial contribution of Einstein wasn't the math, but it was this phenomenology, making this connection. I think with general relativity, if we see it getting even more subtle, and you all know how tricky it can be worrying about gauge ambiguities and stuff like that, right? Given the math, figure out exactly what we can observe, what it's going to be like. And then this comes back in spades in quantum mechanics, of course, where it's pretty clear that the Schrodinger equation and what we got in the mid, in 1925 or so, is great math, and people still argue about what it means. How exactly we get apparent randomness in the frog perspective coming out of this mathematical structure, for example. Okay? And that's a separate talk altogether, how to do that. And I just want to make the point that one shouldn't dismiss the difficulty of recognizing the correct math when one sees it. And with quantum gravity, it's clearly going to have to be even harder if it's going to have all things like superpositions of distances, superpositions of time durations. Right? And then suppose some genie snuck in during the night and wrote down on his board here the correct equations of quantum gravity. I'm not convinced that all of us would recognize that that was it. I'm not convinced that anybody of us would recognize it, actually. Just because getting from that view to this view is actually very tricky.
I just need a quick
clarification.
Suppose you're in something, just for example, like if a yellow box that says PDEs.
Yeah.
I assume there is one. Are you interested in the frog's eye view of PDEs in general, or some particular PDE, or some solution?
Excellent question. So when you specify mathematical structure, you have to be a real stickler, and there's distinctions between all the things you say. You can define a mathematical structure corresponding to some particular PDE with all solutions to it, or you could look at one particular solution to it, some particular boundary condition. These are all different structures, right? Even the real line, you know, you have to distinguish between the vector space R and the metric space R, only with different distances are defined, where there's no origin, and the real line, where you can also multiply points. These are all different structures, so you need to be very careful.
So is the hope that there's a phenomenology for each one of them, or only
yes, for each one of them, yes. And of course, for starters, it would be nice to find one which corresponds to our universe and be able to do the phenomenology for that. But I think it's a very useful intellectual exercise in general, asking what do you do as a mathematician if someone gives you a mathematical structure and says, is this it? And most of this new paper talks about that. And since I guess you want me to stop about 5 minutes past or so, I won't go into hardly any details about that at all. You can read about it. But the thing I find very interesting is that there are a number of things you can do with any mathematical structure, which already start pointing you to it, just give you a little bit of the feeling of emergence of certain properties. So if someone gives you a mathematical structure and says, well, analyze this to see if there's any, what it would be like living in this universe, if there's any observers in it and whatnot. The first thing that you would do is look at the symmetry group of it, the automorphism group of it. Any mathematical structure has an automorphism group, a group of transformations you can do that leave all the structure intact, right? It might be Poincaré symmetry, it might be something completely different. And once you have the symmetry group, this is something, again, I ramble on for a long time but in this paper, there are a number of interesting things you can do. So building on the course that Wigner and others took in the 30s, looking at irreducible representations of that group and irreducible group actions more generally, which of course, you know, if you ask a particle, if I ask one of you guys, you know, what's a particle, you might glibly say, oh, it's irreducible representation of the Poincaré group. And I found it quite interesting that a number of those things pop out actually from any mathematical structure. It doesn't have to have anything to do with space-time or Poincaré symmetry. There's a whole host of issues also to do with how you actually define things rigorously, and if you even can. As you know, Gödel, of course, through a monkey wrench into all this by showing that there are a lot of mathematical structures which have undecidable statements in them, or where the relations are uncomputable, undefined. So one third hypothesis, which I think is very interesting, might well be wrong, although I would actually put my money on it, is what I'm calling the computable universe hypothesis. That, in fact, our mathematical structure that we live in is one which is Gödel complete. It's Turing computable. And I'll get back to that a little bit more later if there's time. That severely cuts down on what you're allowed to do. It's a massive pruning. And it might even help explain to some extent why our universe is so simple, because there's so much that gets killed off there. If I want to make sure I get some rotten tomatoes or at least some snowballs thrown at me, go really speculative here towards the end, and just talk about first implications for parallel universes. As you know, this is something which really makes people foam at the mouth. You're going to have Lenny Susskind out here in March, aren't you, Lee? And some people love it, and other people sit and grumble, this isn't science, is what Paul Feinhardt would say. But Alex Valenkin thinks it's pretty inevitable. And sometimes people even disagree with their thesis advisor here. David Gross loves to say, I hate it. Which Frank Wilczek and even Lisa Randall is more with the idea. And then a lot of people who work on the collision physics like the idea because they feel that some aspects of it are predicted by their work. What about, are there any implications pro or con from the mathematical universe hypothesis? I think yes, I think there is actually. If we buy the mathematical universe hypothesis, if you buy a hypothesis that we live in a mathematical structure, then it's interesting to ask, well, how many bits of information does it take to specify our mathematical structure? Okay. You are all hoping that the mathematical structure is simple enough that a finite number of bits work, otherwise they'll overrun the page limits of the journal where you try to describe it when you publish it, right? And you would love it if it's 1,000 bits, or if you can at least fit it in a 20-page paper, right? When we look around us in the universe, however, from the Frog perspective, it appears that we need a vast number of bits to specify the position of every tree, the position of every planet, and so on. In fact, if inflation really happened, then these seed fluctuations that we see throughout our Hubble volume are Gaussian fluctuations, apparently drawn from the Gaussian random field, which is easy to prove mathematically, are essentially incompressible, these random numbers. So you might easily need a Google or so bits to describe what we see. So then you have this interesting situation that if you're looking for a simple, by which I mean less than 10 to the 100 bits, mathematical theory of everything, you are in fact looking for a multiverse theory. Because otherwise, if you can describe it, give a complete description of reality in a small number of bits, right, it would predict a larger number of bits. So of course, by assumption impossible, right? If there's a multiverse, the way you get out of this is the simple mathematical theory that you can then publish, even on four pages perhaps, in your favorite journal, predicts an ensemble with lots and lots and lots of different frog perspectives. And almost all the bits in the description go into just saying which element in the ensemble, which parallel universe we live in. So that the theory itself is very simple. You don't have to specify that this tree and that is here and that tree is there, because there's another parallel universe where the trees are in different places. And almost all the measurements we make of the trees just tell us their address.
Isn't that equivalent to saying, if you have such a simple mathematical theory, you won't be able to predict anything? So if you then can, if you're predicting a bunch of different things with different outcomes, isn't that equivalent to not being able to tell what the prediction is?
It certainly would mean that you cannot predict all of the, you would not be able to predict 10 to the 100 bits. That's for sure. Right? You would still be able to, you would still hope that you would be able to measure this many bits in that case in our universe. That would still provide a test of the theory. There should be certain regularities which hold across the whole ensemble. And I'll come back to some examples of that just now. Because there have been a lot of different types of parallel universes that have been discussed by various people. And it's very important not to mix them up with each other. The simplest kind, which I like to call level one, is just different Hubble volumes. If space is infinite, like inflation generically predicts, then there are, of course, infinitely many volumes of space like this, which provide parallel universes of sorts. And then people like Alan Guth and Alex Blinken, like... Wow, I didn't know I... could just... You're so far ahead of us here, Fritter, just by thinking, turn off the lights. In eternal inflation, you'll also get a whole sequence of infinite universes, which are regions of space, in the same space-time scale, which is separated by an inflating space. And then, if you believe in the many-world interpretation of quantum physics, you also have elsewhere in Hilbert space other decoherent branches where other things happen. And finally, if you wanted to add this level four multiverse, the idea that all mathematical structures describe have the same status, so that then there's our mathematical structure we live in and also others. Now, and coming back to your very excellent question here about if you can predict anything, basically the bigger the multiverse is, right, the simpler the theory, the less bits of information, the less algorithmic complexity the theory itself has to have. So you make a huge shading already at level one here, because if you just have eternal inflation and you have an infinite space with these Gaussian fluctuations which it predicts, then you don't have to explain our initial conditions, why it's a little bit overdense here and less overdense there, and why Earth formed here and not 1 yard to the left. Because somewhere else in space, in our same space, there's another Hubble volume which is like that, right? So maybe you only have to specify 10 to the 3 bits or so, giving a bunch of decimals for the parameters of a standard model of particle physics. But you don't have to specify in your fundamental theory the initial conditions, because they're all realized somewhere in this level 1 multiverse. Then you can economize still further if you have some sort of landscape. It doesn't have to be the string landscape, but it could be that the loop quantum gravity or any other theory might have more than one solution corresponding to an effective vacuum state, an effective state that space can be in and then inflate and fill up a whole Hubble volume like this. If there's many solutions corresponding to different values of some of the standard model parameters, right, then the overall theory that describes all this has still less algorithmic complexity, because it doesn't have to specify what those parameters are. It predicts the whole ensemble. And then by measuring that alpha is what it is in this universe, say, if that's one of those parameters, you're just figuring out that we live in a yellow bubble rather than the red one. This one gives nothing qualitatively new, which is a little bit ironic, since poor Hugh Everett got so much flack for it, couldn't get a job. Too bad the Perimeter Institute didn't open in 1957. I would write him a strong recommendation letter, but he had to leave physics. But it doesn't give you any more variety than you already have at this level here. Finally, if you take this point of view, that all mathematical structures have the same ontological status, it's not like Stephen Hawking said that someone has to go breathe fire into the equations of one structure to make that be a universe, but rather you're just saying mathematical structure, mathematical existence, physical existence, or equivalent, then there's nothing to specify. You don't even have to say which mathematical structure, because you know, they're all out there in math space. When Lenny Susskind comes, and when you pick up New York Times or popular books, you'll notice a huge amount of literature on parallel universes, which tend to focus at the moment, that's the trendiest thing, on level two here. And there are, in fact, four different sub-levels that that naturally splits into also. You can say, you have the same effective laws of physics, same minimum, you're just in a different post-inflationary region. Or you can be in a different minimum and the effective supergravity potential might be a few. Or you can have different fluxes so that the supergravity potential itself is different. Or you can have a different space-time complexification. But in all of these cases, it's the same fundamental laws of physics, same mathematical structure. Just different effective laws. So is five, let's see, what is there, when is the drop dead time here? We start, I guess I started talking about 10 past.
Yeah, it starts a little late, yeah.
Can I talk 10 past, or do you want me to stop? No. Okay. You might be, I was afraid you would be afraid to stop me with a So going, okay, so going still more crazy, let's talk about the simulation hypothesis. A number of people have asked this question, you know, do we actually live in a computer simulation? Who's seen The Matrix? Raise your hand. Oh, yeah. It's been in pop culture for a long time, but a number of other people have speculated about it too, like Frank Kipler, Nick Bostrom, Jürgen Schmidhuber, Seth Lloyd, and many, many others. And so there's a number of interesting things we can discuss about that. First, of course, there are some people who just say flat out no, like Gordon McCabe and Roger Penrose have argued for various reasons that no, it's not possible for this to be at least a classical digital computer simulation. What people like Bostrom and others have worked on it clearly is how likely it is. Suppose it is possible to build a supercomputer which can simulate something that feels like me. You know, what's the probability then that I'm a simulated me or quote the real me? That clearly has to do with a so-called measure problem, which is totally unsolved in my opinion. You know, if you have many different copies of things that feel like me, you know, what's the probability that I'm one of them rather than another one? And this is really plaguing this whole business of making any prediction from inflation at the moment. It's an unsolved problem. That doesn't mean we can dismiss the whole question. It just means that there's a lot of work to do. I want to make a different remark here. I think there's actually very interesting relations between computations, which underlies the whole simulation question, and mathematical structures and formal systems. Formal systems describe in mathematically rigorous ways both computations and mathematical structures, sets of relations, elements of relations. A mathematical structure is, in model theory, or said to be a model of a formal system. Computations can write down a rather simple computer program for a universal Turing machine, which will compute all theorems of a finite formal system. And mathematical structures can be defined by computations. Specify the algorithm, specify all the relations, either by giving some table or something, or by computation. And computations are just special cases of mathematical structures. The reason I've drawn a question mark in the middle here is because my sense is that maybe this is what you were getting at with that question towards the beginning also. We humans have come up with the idea of a formal system, the idea of a mathematical structure, the idea of a computation. My feeling is that these are all just different facets of one sort of unified transcendent notion of some sort of structure, some sort of transcendent structure, which is out there, which is the whole universe, the whole multiverse, and which is also the thing that mathematicians have studied. And I would very much welcome people thinking more about how these different things are interrelated. Now, while I'm on the topic, so coming back to the question of whether we live in a computer simulation, one critique I have here is I think it's a lot of these nice sci-fi movies and things are written by people who don't know how it worked that much in physics. I think it's quite unjustified to identify this one-dimensional computational sequence of a computer with our one-dimensional flow of time in physics. Particularly if you think of general relativity, we can time, but there isn't necessarily a V time. If you think of quantum physics, we have a whole wave function evolving unitarily. It's not at all clear that it should make any difference if you pick the t-coordinate or evolve in some other way. There's also often very, very little said in these ideas of simulation about how to identify, say, the general the quantum gravity universe with an evolving bit string, and where the three dimensions, four dimensions are supposed to even come sailing in from, and stuff like that. So my sense is that, particularly because of this correspondence we talked about, that the computation doesn't really need to evolve the universe at all. It specifies it. All the relations can be between the entities can be specified by computations. And if you can think of reality either as a three-dimensional place, which is evolving with time, right? Or you can think of it like Einstein as a four-dimensional space-time, which just is. So then if your life is a movie, your life is really the whole videotape. That's space-time. There's nothing happening there. So suppose you have a computer which is so advanced that it can just store the whole four-dimensional space-time of our Hubble volume in its memory. Now, why isn't that as good a computer simulation as one that just outputs one time slice at a time? Now, storing it should be just why do you need to compute anything? And then if you buy that, then, why do you have to store it in such a dumb format of storing, all that extra data when you know that you can do some really clever data compression? An image, who cares if it's stored in JPEG or GIF, right? We can do fantastic data compression using the laws of physics by just storing some initial Cauchy hypersurface, for example. And at that point, you're very far already from the whole notion of the matrix, where what the computer is doing is computing anything. So this is, I think, just a wide open question, which it's fun to think more about. And wanted to throw it out there. And while I'm drawing crazy triangles, let me throw up one last one, the famous Bermuda Triangle that Roger Penrose likes to draw, with matter, mind, and math. And this possible paradox that the question is matter something which evolved, comes from math, like I'm proposing, and is mind something, this is just a manifestation of matter doing stuff, and is math just something that mind made up? Which was a question I got from you there towards the beginning. My own philosophical guess is that this is resolved. I like to think of it, I really believe that it's all a mathematical structure, ultimately, and then everything else comes from there. But that's just me. And to conclude, why should you believe in any of this? Well, for starters, you might believe in it because you really believe in the idea of an external reality which is independent of us humans. If you don't believe in that, we can also consider Eugene Wigner here. Of course, it's been remarked already by Galileo that somehow mathematics is the language of nature and that there are all these spectacular mathematical regularities, right? And yet after he noticed that, more and more mathematical regularities became discovered. And back in the 60s, Wigner wrote this famous essay that many of you have probably read on the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in the physical sciences, where he said, this is really unreasonable that math should work so well. There's just got to be some explanation for it. Well, the mathematical universe hypothesis, of course, gives an explanation. It says the reason math is such a good description is because nature is math. Nature is mathematical. If that's true, then what we're seeing isn't that math is a good approximation for physics, but rather that simple math can sometimes be a good approximation for other math. In other words, we haven't found a theory of quantum gravity that's convinced everybody, but we found certain approximations of one mathematical theory and some limits, like general relativity, like quantum field theory, which work well. And it's well known that math can often approximate math. And if you would have made this argument with Wigner in the 60s, the prediction would be then that future physics, after he wrote the essay, should find more regularities, more mathematical regularities in nature. And sure enough, you got standard model of particle physics, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that gives you sort of a warm and fuzzy feeling for the idea. To conclude the crazy part here, and just leave a little bit of time for questions, I spoke a bunch about why I think cosmology is very exciting. And then I started talking about really crazy stuff, external reality hypothesis, and how I argue that it implied mathematical universe hypothesis, which implied various things for physics. And I'd like to conclude by saying that I think ultimately the main reason why stuff like this is so controversial is because we're not taking this guy with a beard seriously enough. Now, who is this?
God.
Yes, this is Charles Darwin. He made a prediction, which I think has a lot to do with physics. He said that the reason I am the way I am is because that's what was useful for my ancestors, what had survival value back in the jungle and savannas and so on. Right? So what does that predict about physics? It predicts that I should have pretty good intuition for ice hockey and for things that are moving with sort of human speeds, human velocities, because if I don't have a good intuition for the parabolic trajectory of a flying rock, you know, I might get hit in the head by one, or fail in my hunting mission, or fall off a cliff or something, right? That clearly, having a good intuition for the human scale physics has clear survival value, right? However, if some guy or some woman was sitting outside of the cave thinking really deeply about what would happen if you divided yourself into 10 to 26 pieces, you know, she might not notice a tiger sneaking up from behind and get cleaned right out of the gene pool. No. Having intuition for quantum physics or relativity had no survival value at all. So Darwin predicts we shouldn't have any intuition for what happens when you leave the human scale. So that's the prediction made hundreds of years ago. What's the data? Well, special relativity comes along. You look at what happens when things go much faster than we had evolved to have intuition for. We learn that time slows down. It's pretty weird and counterintuitive, if you ask me. Then we look what happens if you make things much bigger than the human scale, and you get things like black holes. That's pretty weird and counterintuitive, if you ask me. Then you look at what happens when things get really small, and it seems like particles can be in two places at once in the superposition. That's pretty weird, if you ask me. All of these things are confirming exactly Darwin's prediction. Right? Things should seem weird as soon as you venture away from the human scale of things. Then you look at what happens when you cool something down to much colder temperatures than we humans have ever been able to evolve with, and you get liquid helium flowing out of the flask upwards. Now, that's pretty weird. Then you make things much hotter than we humans experienced. You smash particles together at CERN, you smash together an electron and a positron, you know, and out comes some W bosons and stuff like that, right? That's about as intuitive to me as if you smash together an apple and a pear and out pops two oranges, a banana, and a watermelon. So I think this prediction has really been borne out. We should predict the correct theory of physics to seem totally counterintuitive. And therefore, dismissing things just because they sound weird is like dismissing Darwin, basically. It's very popular to do in the country it was in yesterday. But I think we don't want to make that mistake. So thank you very much for hearing me out.
I know this has been said before, and I'll say it again. With respect to the parallel universes and multi-universe, you said that we can only get a complete picture of reality, something like that in theory. However, I only have one reality. I live in this one universe.
You can only observe this, yes.
This is the only reality I'll ever know.
That's right. That's from our fraud perspective. That's right. It's very limited. agree.
So why don't I just stick to that limited picture, which is what we've done in the past since before even Aristotle.
I think there's no contradiction at all between what you said and what I said. You're just saying that, so let me just come back to the, picture here. You are saying that the frog perspective, which is what we actually see sort of in our face here, is all you find interesting, and you want to focus on that. And I respect that. I think it's a perfectly reasonable point of view. However, I would posit that even if you try to be very hard-nosed and push it that way, you will still tend to also acknowledge the existence of some things that you can never see. Like, for example, you know, interiors of black holes. If we can never go observe them, right? So you might say this is not science to talk about the interior, what's inside an event horizon. But the logic of the thing is, what we're really testing isn't the idea that there is something beyond the event horizon. We're testing theory of general relativity. That's the theory. The theory of general relativity predicts that there is this unobservable stuff inside of black holes. It predicts how it should behave. And it also predicts the perihelion shift of Mercury and all a host of other things that we can test. Okay? So because it predicts a bunch of things that we can test, we then have credence in this theory and are willing to take seriously its predictions for things we can't see also. So the analogy there is, so just like general relativity gives you black holes inside and outside, inflation, cosmological inflation, predicts a whole bunch of things we can test, like it predicts that omega should be 1 plus minus 10 to minus 5. We've measured it to be 1.009 plus minus 1%. And it's predicted a number of other things. And it also predicts space is infinite, so there should be other regions that we can't see. And just because it's that theory has been so successful in predicting things we can test, we find it useful to also take seriously other things it predicts. Theories. We can't just say, I'm going to believe in some aspects of general relativity and not others, right? Pick and choose. And it's exactly the same with inflation. You can keep track of your word.
I'm not sure I understand what the methodology is. It seems to me the suggestion is that everything that lives in a mathematical space exists in some sense, and that we want to explore the phenomenology of various mathematical structures, considered generally or more specifically. Is that?
Yeah, well, I think to a large extent that's what you already are doing.
You
write down some equations on your board and you study them.
So what is this perspective at? I mean, because I think that is, we don't look at the whole set, we're not interested in the phenomenology of the rational numbers because that would seem to be too,
to see any
phenomenology
coming out of it. So right, because it's just too simple to contain it in itself. Where
there's no complexity.
Right.
So what are you recommending as a shift? What does the shift in perspective entail as far as practice?
In terms of what I suggest you work on tomorrow, I'm recommending you keep doing what you're doing, basically. I think first of all, it's always interesting to just ask philosophically what it all ultimately might be leading towards. And that's much of the spirit of pushing it in this way. There are also a lot of people who really do get very agitated about some of these predictions from some of these theories, like parallel universes, say, right? And as soon as somebody is talking about it, right, if they choose to show interest in it, then I think one has no choice but to actually say, confront these sort of questions in an honest way. I think in terms of sort of non-standard things I would encourage people to think about, right? This is one. I really think there is a whole camp of computer scientists who do their thing and think about Church-Turing computability and stuff. There's mathematicians who do their things and think about undecidability. There's physicists who do our thing. I think for these disparate groups, the people to talk more to each other might very well lead to some very deep and interesting insights. And it might well reveal further relations between these these fields. And that's also very much in the spirit of what you do. You bring together people from different walks of life here at Pearl River and put coffee on the table and make them talk, right?
Well, in the spirit of the mathematical universe, it has been suggested that the probabilistic nature of quantum mechanical predictions has something to do with the non-computability or Gödel's incompleteness. But you seem to go the other way around. You seem to say that, never mind the probabilistic nature of quantum mechanical predictions, you still think that everything should be computable and we are in a universe where everything is completed. How do you reconcile the probabilistic nature of quantum mechanical predictions with purely sort of static picture of axioms?
So that's a very good question. And my answer is that things with everything is perfectly well defined from the bird perspective. So if you just take Everett's point of view, right, then you have unitary physics, the wave function of the universe evolves completely deterministically, right? According to this unitary time evolution, there's nothing random that happens to the wave function. The randomness all happens in the frog perspective. Right? We perceive that rather random things happen if I have a Sturm-Gerlach apparatus and so on and so forth. And I believe, I'm personally a many worlds guy. Right? So what I believe is that if you analyze carefully the mathematical structure of unitary quantum physics, you find you have all these effectively decoherent things which act as, for all practical purposes, parallel universes here. And this apparent randomness we see is basically telling us that, in fact, my mental state is entering a superposition, and then both of them get realized. So the randomness only happens then in the frog perspective, and not here in the Wernicke perspective. In that view.
So that's it. I think what you're doing is very useful, because a lot of people have a vague sort of intuitive plate in a sense that that the world is mathematical, and what you're doing is you're taking to its logical conclusion. And if it's right, it's tremendously profound, but if it's wrong, it's profoundly wrong. And
hopefully at least wrong in an interesting way.
It's profoundly wrong, and I think the key is time and the disappearance of time is the implication of what you just said, actually answered both the last two questions, is that in taking the bird's eye view, the experience of the flow of time and the notion of the present moment disappears, and one has to argue is emergent.
Yes.
There is an opposite point of view, and one argument for the opposite point of view is formulated by Roberto Longo, who's a philosopher that I mentioned to you at Harvard. And Unger takes the point of view that what you do when you make your mathematical universe hypothesis is you hypothesize that relations that in the world, in the real world, take place in time, causal relations and other relations that unfold in time, relations of present, past, future, are subsumed into a network of logical relations which are timeless. Because the assumption is that these mathematical systems just, quote, exist. There's no unfolding or flowing in time. And so Roberto, I don't want to summarize what's part of the book that you just published, but Roberto makes the argument that what you've done is eliminate an essential aspect of our observations of the world, which is that there is an experience of the present moment, there is an experience of the flow of time. And he argues from that, if we take that as not mistaken, as actually part of reality, then running your argument backwards, mm-hmm. that's proof that the mathematical universe hypothesis is false. That is, that there is essential aspects of reality that we experience that are not mathematical.
Yeah, that's a very interesting argument that I think I completely agree with everything you said here, that it's useful to push ideas to the extreme, regardless of whether they ultimately turn out to be right or wrong, to see where they go. And like Moffat and many others have been doing with general relativity, for example, exploring various alternative things, pushing them to see what happens, I think is very much what you want to do here also. I think one should try as hard as one can with various mathematical structures to see if one can get time to come out as an emergent thing. And if that fails, it's telling us something super interesting. And vice versa.
Just a question relates to that. So in order for this approach to be completed, you have to draw the arrows from the bird's eye view to the frog's eye view.
Yes.
And in order for this
structure... Although what we're doing, of course, is we've observed this, and we're trying to figure out, is there something over a structure over here which, well, when you do the arrow, matches what we see.
But it's got to be more than that, because this is going to be the right theory. So there's got to be a unique set of arrows from here that tells us how the frogs... in other words, those arrows have to come out of the mathematical structure.
Yeah.
Otherwise, that account of theory isn't complete.
That's right.
And these examples worries me if that's possible.
Although, it's very difficult, of course. Because even if you have the right, if you have a mathematical theory to predict what the phenomenology of it is, first of all, hard. And then after that, we're doing an inverse problem of looking at, well, the limited measurements with noise and such here, trying to figure out which one of the ones it ultimately was. It might not be possible to even uniquely say which of the mathematical structures are.
But it has to be possible in principle, it's difficult to structures, otherwise your problem doesn't work.
Right.
I'd like to go back to Fatih's question about predictability, because if, as you go from the bird's view to the frog's view, you find that there are many possible frog views.
Yes. As the case is in many theories.
As the multi type of ideas. I mean, then the problem is, can you explain anything? Or is there enough, for example, in terms of correlations between, so for example, if you find a defined structure constant at this value, then you must find the cosmological constant to have that value, and that's a locked-in, firm prediction
precisely.
Of the theory. If you don't have that, if anything's possible, including possible laws of physics being very different from place to place, what do you have, right?
Exactly.
What can you do with it?
Exactly. I think that's a very valid point. One source of optimism, I feel, is that we can cheat. We can look around and see what is our world actually like. Right? And we find that it's remarkably simple in teeming with regularities of different sorts. So, which suggests that if this is a typical world where there's sentient observers, that they might ultimately be able to predict something with a lot of regularity. But that's just the sort of fuzzy arguments you keep in your mind when you go to a bookmaker and try to figure out what you should bet your money on.
Well. For every statement, there's almost a counterstatement. For example, the last one, we look around and we find a world that's remarkably simple. But I can equally say we look around and we find a world that's remarkably complex. Physicists make their money by getting rid of the complex and focusing on the simple.
Yes.
And as words increase relative to equations, those are the people who say, we deal with the complex. You guys have pretty easy problems. So that's a comment. But what I wondered about external reality hypothesis, is there a corresponding internal reality hypothesis? Or is the implication of the hypothesis that there is no internal reality?
So those are two very interesting points. Let me comment on both of them in order. First of all, I think the first point you made is very valid. And Wigner, of course, has written a whole book on the subject where he puts it very nicely. But yet, I think you can't say that if you look at the gauge group, SG3 cross SG2 cross U1, and that's a pretty simple one in the space of all gauge groups. Why not SU4511 cross something, So there are some things which seem to be simpler than they somehow could be. Up to the second question of the internal reality. So in this picture, there's just one reality, and this is how it feels when you're in a mathematical structure. I think the point you raised ties in very interestingly with the fact that what we're really doing in physics actually is not trying to predict this from this, but actually trying to predict something rather intermediate, which in the article I'm calling it, I call it the consensus view. My subjective reality disappears every time I blink, and it turns upside down every time I stand on my head, and so on. And so I have all this interpolation going on. And what I'm actually trying to predict isn't all this funky stuff which is related to my eyelids and how my brain is wired up, but the thing which I've inferred seems to have some more permanent status, which I seem to share with you, right? And a bird sees four primary colors, a cat sees only black and white, bats see with ultrasound. They all have a very different frog perspective than us, right? But we've identified this sort of common ground, this consensus
But if the reality of the log experience is any less real than the external part that you could achieve consensus on, that is the question. Is consciousness a valid reality referent relative to the other things?
Well, ultimately, real and conscious and all these things are human words, ultimately, which have no explicit meaning in this picture at all. So the way I think of it is, you start with this. When you're an infinitely smart mathematician, you calculate that there's going to be in here all these observers, and some of them are going to come up with this language where they talk about things being real and so on, and that's what it ultimately all means. So I don't know if I can say any more about them.
Well, can I just, it seems to me the question is, why in that triangle did you go from mathematics to matter to mind rather than from mathematics straight to mind? It's cut out the middle bit.
By me.
I mean, that's
but except for the point of the consensus theory. You see, I think that many people like to dismiss the idea of finding and looking for fundamental theory before you've solved the puzzle of consciousness. I disagree with that. I think that there are two deep mysteries, and they do decouple to some extent, because this consensus reality where we have a space or stuff happens and so on, which we can all agree on, and it doesn't go away when I close my eyes, right? That intermediate description of reality is common, not just to people, but to the cats and dogs and the computers with computers or other measurement devices could also be probing that very same reality, where the whole business of consciousness doesn't really enter in the same way. So I think that to get from here to this intermediate view, you don't have to fully understand how the human mind works and why it feels the way it does. And I don't want to, in any way, downplay the fascination of that mystery. I'm just saying I think we physicists shouldn't blame our lack of understanding consciousness on our failure to... We shouldn't blame our failure to find a theory of everything on the fact that we haven't studied consciousness yet.
And you're lying, but thanks. There's one thing which sort of puzzles me, which is this caricature of how we physicists work, which is that sort of we write equations on the blackboard and then we study them, and that's what we physicists do. And I find that it sort of has nothing to do with really how.
Did I say that?
You just said yeah. Or as when Steve was asking a question, and that was sort of your remark. And I find that very odd because it's not at all how I think what I'm doing. So I think when I write down the equation, the hard part of my work has already been done. And the hard part has nothing to do with math. It's trying to understand what would be the equation that I would write down. What would be the meaning of the entities? And
so in a way, you're saying the hard part is the inverse problem. You look at something and see, can I find an equation which describes that?
Yeah, so the equation is something that is very much in the background when I'm working, basically. And basically, what I'm thinking is that when I can write down the equation, then I'm done. That's the goal. And it's never the other way around, ever. Right? I mean, there are a lot of people who sort of do that. They there's this great mathematical structure, and then they go off and then study quantum groups with them, blah 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 blah. And draw colorful graphs and say, look, but it could be quantum gravity or something like that, right? It's sort of but I mean, it seems to me it's sort of the biggest cubes, right? It's a way to get fun. I don't know, but I think it's not what the real job is.
I think
so. I'm very skeptical of this program. Because if you go down this road, it's
I'm flattered that you call it a program. It's more just some scattered philosophical remarks. I think the greatest strength, frankly, of the physics community is that we're not this ideological monoculture where everybody's doing the same thing. I think one of the greatest strengths of us as physicists is that different physicists come at this with very different approaches and try very different things. I think that's what ultimately makes it so strong, and I hope we can keep doing that, approaching things in very, very different ways, because only then are we going to maximize our odds of succeeding.
As you speak about the philosophical implications of certain scientific theories, it made me wonder about the
ideological implications, especially since you ended with Darwin. It's probably pretty fair to say that Darwin was also legitimizing the principles of capitalism by claiming that ruthless competition is only natural, right? And that to a certain degree, maybe theories of multiverses work pretty well with current philosophies of liberalism.
Oh, yeah?
And liberalism is only to validate a Jew's claim, you only have to say which universe you're coming from, and then have to have a general formula to acknowledge that other universes exist. Yeah. Yeah? And that's what made me wonder what your ideological states are. You don't seem to be happy with liberalism because you want a kind of consensus that goes beyond that. So what are your politics?
Thank you. You just gave me the perfect excuse next time I get a parking ticket. I mean, you said, oh, I thought it was legal to park here. And, oh, that was the other problem. But I think, in terms of ideology, I think it's also worth, at least if I introspect and ask about my ideology and how I feel about life, that it's striking really how little correlation there is, I think, between my joie de vivre and my beliefs about ultimate ontology. I mean, if you are a person who is very fundamentally religious and believes that that your life sucks and that the only justification is just you're going to get to listen to an infinite harp concert after you die, right? Then it makes sense if someone comes to tell you that that's not right. But on the other hand, if that's not who you are, right, then if you get your joy from spending time with friends, with your children, listening to nice music and things like that, if that's what makes you excited to get up in the morning, I don't think it's going to have any profound impact on your enjoyment of life or on your politics. Exactly what's going on with ontology. I'd be interested if you disagree.
Maybe that's a good place to write.
Quick follow-up. If I understand you correctly, there will be a parallel universe where everything is pretty much the same as here. Perhaps, right? Because there will be so many parallel universes. So everything will be pretty much the same, except perhaps you will be out there, we will be here, but you will be telling us the opposite of what you are telling us now. But why would I believe you?
We should all move to the bistro, and this sounds like they had a beer. I have to really catch up, kind of an end here because we're teaching class here 10 minutes ago, so I need to really.